Good morning. May it please the court, my name is John O'Gara. I represented Mr. Elvis at the district court level, and I've been appointed to represent Mr. Ellis here before this honorable court. We have in many respects here an unusual case, to say the least. It does involve, by my belief, a case of first impression on a couple different levels, and I want to note that, of course, as with many criminal cases, the facts here, or the decision here by this court, of course, is very fact-intensive. What we have here is, on first impression, by my count, on two different levels, is whether a threat must be communicated to a witness in order for the guideline under United States Sentencing Guideline 2J1.2B1, whether it applies. There have been other cases that have been cited in the government's brief and that we have encountered that stand for the proposition that, in fact, the threat does not have to be communicated to the witness. It can be communicated to another individual. Seventh Circuit, by my reckoning, has not specifically decided that issue. But it's more troubling in this case, and the bottom line on the appeal in this case is whether and did this defendant threaten to cause physical injury to a person. And that's why this thing, the whole case really turns on the progression of discussions that are had by Mr. Ellis and by the undercover agent who is Rudy McIntosh. The progression of discussions between the two of them is really key to deciding whether this 8-point or 8-level increase really should apply. What we've got, of course, is an individual in Rudy McIntosh, who is an agent at the time, and all of these conversations are being taped. Now, the beginning of this is a conversation between Mr. Ellis and Mr. McIntosh about a witness who Mr. Ellis is very concerned with, who he thinks is going to, in fact, say things to the United States government and who may very well land him in prison. And in his discussions with Mr. McIntosh, when they begin on October the 6th of 2004, the first series of discussions deals with destroying that witness's credibility. There is much conversation between the two of them about, well, she's not a very good person of good repute. She may be a prostitute. She may have been recently involved with marijuana possession. We need to destroy her credibility. Now, Mr. Ellis's language is colorful, to say the least, throughout all this. And one can look at it in many different ways. That may be, in fact, one of the problems with using this 8-level increase to compared to what he actually said to Mr. McIntosh, and say that that entitles him to an 8-level increase for threatening to cause physical injury to a person. In that very first discussion on October 6th, while they're talking about credibility, and he uses language like take her ASS off the street, that he wants to destroy and kill her credibility, that he wants to neutralize her. The two of these gentlemen then have a discussion the very next day, on October the 7th. And in that, Mr. McIntosh, the government informant, says, well, you know, that we can maybe look at maybe some marijuana with her and investigating her. And frankly, Mr. Ellis, as an aside, is guilty of the crime after the first conversation on October the 6th. That's very clear. He is recruiting, who is an assistant police chief for the city of East St. Louis, he's recruiting him to try to crash in somebody's credibility by involving them in an investigation for marijuana. The conversation on the 7th then, the agent, the government agent, says to Mr. Ellis, it's going to take more than marijuana. If you're going to want to really get at her credibility, you need to do something more than that. It's going to take some more investigation. We need to pin something else on her. At that point, Ellis says, well, how far does this thing, how far do you want it to go? And Ellis responds, I want it to go all the way. She's a prostitute. We can investigate her for that. He again echoes the sentiment throughout these discussions with McIntosh that he, Mr. Ellis, wants this witness's credibility destroyed. On the 13th of October, another conversation takes place in which he talks about wanting her locked up. And at that point, it is my belief that there is this picture that's included with the government's brief here where Rudy McIntosh says, marijuana ain't going to do it. You need something more. Here's some crack cocaine that perhaps we can plant on her. Now, again, this is give and take between the two of these, and it is centered on credibility and trying to pin obviously, a false crime on a witness. That is obstruction of justice, absolutely, no doubt about it. We then have a break for a little over a month, and on November the 18th, there's this discussion about, well, where is this witness these days, and Mr. Ellis is trying to pin her down with some sort of address. The 19th of November, then, there is discussions about taking her ASS off the streets, planting crack upon her at that point. In fact, interestingly enough, in the appendix, one of the conversations involves another government informant by the name of Danita Youngblood, who, in mentioning this witness, uses the following language. I'll F her up in a minute. That's at page 39, section 6. It's approximately 51 minutes and 10 seconds into the conversation. So they're really the first time anybody's talking about any sort of physical threat to the witness is, in fact, the government's other cooperating witness at that point, Danita Youngblood. We now go to the 22nd. In the next series of conversations here. Rudy McIntosh, who has initiated the escalation of the obstruction all along here, says to Ellis, you know that crack that we've been talking about, now that's only a 10-year thing. What you need, at that point Ellis then says, look, I'm not concerned with how, I'm not concerned with what, I want her credibility destroyed. At that point, the government agent, Rudy McIntosh, says, we can dispose of her. I ain't talking about crack. It is not initiated by Mr. Ellis, but by the government agent in this case. Indicates all we got to do, my client then says, all we got to do is discredit her. Don't get yourself in trouble. Don't get Danita in trouble. Don't do anything to hurt yourself in this thing. Mr. McIntosh is, of course, talking to the FBI during this whole conversation and during this tape. He's going back and forth with them. Well, then he indicates to my client, well, I know some people, and I know these people that can take care of her and dispose of her and kill her. And at that point, and again, none of this was initiated by Mr. Ellis. At no point during any of these conversations does Ellis say to the government informant, kill her, hurt her, do what you got to do, he has told her, but he has not at any point instructed, told, meant to be caused to be told to others that that person needs to be threatened. If the court looks, and I know we all have, at every other case that applies this 8-point increase, what we're normally talking about is a threat that's made to another individual, and that threat is from the defendant, him or herself. They have to say to somebody, if you testify, you're going to get hurt. If you testify or your mother testifies, you're going to get hurt. If we look at the cases that have been cited both in the government's brief and in our brief regarding this, I think it's Grapp case, deals with, again, mentioning all of those 8-point level cases where the defendants themselves are the ones who actually issued a threat. For this application, this 8-level increase to apply, one would think that the threat has to come from the defendant's mouth.
What about the conversation on November 19th? I want her dead, dead as a so-and-so.
Your Honor, that when that is being talked about, he's talking about tying this whole thing up. He's talking about tying up the whole ability to destroy her credibility. He is not saying to the government agent, I want her dead as an MF-er. He is saying, I want her...
Well, then why did he say it?
He did not say it directly in response to, what should I do with her? He does
it
not
says,
say...
So what you and I talked about before, that might twist this whole thing, oh, tie it up straight. Dead, and then your man. Dead, dead as a so-and-so. Man, I want her so-and-so taken out.
Your Honor, if I might, my response to that is, if you look at that whole conversation and everyone that's led up to that in context, he is talking about wrapping up the ability to discredit her. He is not saying, I know what those words mean, and I know that they're harsh, as many of his words were during this thing, no doubt.
That's a good trick if you can convince somebody of that.
Well, Mr. O'Gara, is your position...
Dead is
your position that it has to be totally initiated by a defendant, can't be adopted? In other words, I'm not suggesting that you agree that it was adopted here, but I appreciate your argument that so much of the initial conversation seems to be coming from this confidential informant. But can't there be an adoption of that that could constitute the solicitation?
I don't think we do either. We've got acquiescence to the escalation all the way along.
That's an adoption. I mean,
But I would think that for an eight level increase to apply, and we look at all the other cases where it does, we're talking about a situation of specific harm that we're trying to punish. You know, you're threatening people directly or indirectly to keep them from coming into a courthouse and speak the truth. And in this set of circumstances, the only analogy I can think of would be you can't conspire with a government agent. It can't be a conspiracy at that point to distribute drugs, for example, because one half of that conspiracy is all faked. You can't have a crime there because you have two people, one of whom is a government agent and one of whom is escalating this thing all along.
So your position, even if Ellis were to say, I want her removed or I want her killed, let's say he initiated that, you're saying that could never be constitute an eight, support an eight-level enhancement because the partner in the conversation isn't going to be able to carry it out?
No, here's my flip on it. If Ellis had said everything that McIntosh had said, and McIntosh had said everything that Ellis would said, I wouldn't be here right now.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. O'Gara. Mr. Goldsmith?
Good morning. May it please the court. The district court in this case held several days of hearings relative to appellant sentencing. The district court in this case bent over backwards to allow both parties to present all the evidence, whatever evidence they wanted, on the sole issue that's now before this court, that being whether this appellant threatened to cause physical injury to the government's cooperating witness in order to obstruct the administration of justice by preventing her continued cooperation in that federal grand jury investigation, which was ongoing in East St. Louis into election fraud. That very same grand jury investigation, which ultimately resulted in an indictment and charges against this appellant and several others for election fraud, which ultimately was tried, and this appellant was convicted on the election fraud as well.
Can you begin with that last point that counsel made in terms of the role of the informant in all
Sure.
these conversations and his view that if it had been flipped, you know, he wouldn't be here, but the fact that it was a government informant engaged in this, when you use the analogy for conspiracy, you know, you can't conspire with an informant. So why don't you begin with that?
All right. Judge, sure. In this case, as the record below shows and as the district court judge found, there was an escalation. Initially, the appellant approached the deputy police commissioner, unknowing, of course, that the deputy police commissioner was cooperating with the government, with a plan to discredit the government's cooperating witness by arresting her with marijuana or planting drugs. But every time that the cooperating or the government's informant, the deputy police commissioner, made another suggestion to the appellant, it was only after, and again, as the record shows and as the district court found, after the appellant had made some statement, there have been some of those already referenced, I want to take her ASS out, I want to, you know, as how far do you want it, as far as it can go, then the government informant would approach the appellant and suggest, well, do you want that or do you want this? And then the appellant every time, yeah, let's do that, and then we give the government informant information as to how to find the government's cooperating witness, license, vehicle tags, addresses, that type of information on numerous occasions. It escalated, again, as the district court found, based upon how the federal grand jury investigation was proceeding. And in November, I think it was November 18th, this appellant actually appeared before that grand jury as a target. And after that appearance, that's when the appellant became, again, as the record shows from conversations, became desperate to take out the government's cooperating witness, who he believed was really the primary bit of evidence that the government had against him. And he said that on numerous occasions in the taped evidence. I don't really understand the flip-flop. If you go back to the district court's findings, it's very clear that the district court, who listened to all the audio tapes, viewed the videotapes, found that this appellant was not simply acquiescing in what the government's informant wanted to do, but he was initiating, the district court called it, he was proactively involved in throughout this escalation, which ultimately led to the plan to kill the government's cooperating witness. And that's what the record below established. The appellant testified at great length. The government presented evidence, including those audio and videotapes, before the district court. And following those lengthy sentencing hearings, the district court made extensive and detailed findings of fact, which are, of course, contained in the record. Initially, the district court found that, again, based upon the record and based upon the evidence, that the appellant's testimony was not credible. The district court based that upon numerous facts in the record, including the fact that the appellant made several false statements during his testimony. The district court then went on to determine that based upon all of the evidence, and again, these hearings lasted 3 days, covered 3 days, based upon all the evidence, that this appellant had, in fact, threatened to cause physical injury to the government's cooperating witness, and it was in order to prevent her from continuing her cooperation into that grand jury investigation into election fraud. Based upon the record before this court, the district court's findings of fact are based upon the record and are not clearly erroneous. Based upon those findings of fact, the district court then went on and set forth in great detail, applying those facts to the guidelines, and found that, in fact, the facts supported the finding in the pre-sentence investigation report that the application of 2J1.2B1 was pertinent and appropriate here, and applied that and increased appellant's total offense level by the 8 levels. So it's the government's position that once the district court made its extensive findings of fact, it properly applied the guidelines. When you look at the entire record here and what this district judge did, it's clear that what he did was exactly what this court has directed in any other opinions regarding in the context of sentencing. He conducted an extensive sentencing hearing. He allowed both parties sufficient time and the ability to present all the evidence they wanted. And after it was only after those extensive hearings, he made very detailed findings of fact, applied those detailed findings of fact to the guidelines in determining this appellant's total offense level. There's absolutely nothing in the record to support a finding that the district court's findings of fact are clearly erroneous. The record supports the district court's subsequent application of the guidelines. If there are no further questions, the government would simply ask this court to affirm the judgment and sentence of the district court in this case. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Goldsmith. Mr. O'Gara's time had expired, but you may have a minute, Mr. O'Gara, if you wish to respond.
I would ask, I was asked some questions about the discussion between Mr. McIntosh and Mr. Ellis on the 19th of November, where he used debt as an MFer. And if we look at that, if we look at how that conversation progresses, they are talking about, again, killing the credibility of the witness. They are not talking about causing physical harm to the witness. The final matter that I want to bring up is, of course, the government pointed to Mr. Ellis's reaction to this fake homicide picture being thrown to him at the very end. And again, the whole thing is artificial. There of course is no harm, a potential harm being threatened to the witness. The government's brief to the contrary indicates that but for Mr. McIntosh, this horrible deed would have been carried out perhaps, and this witness would have been harmed. That is absolutely not belied by the facts before this court or before the district court. In addition to that, if it's all based on Mr. Ellis's reaction to this faked homicide picture being thrown down upon him, can it be said that had he reacted with revulsion, there would be absolutely no way that the 8-point enhancement would apply? It was part of this artificial creation.
All right. Our thanks to both counsel, and Mr. O'Gara, you have the additional thanks of the court for accepting this appointment.